Do you know the author?
No, I don't, and I don't know the title either. But it's a blue book, and it kind of gives the whole story, you know.
I think we can help you.
Have you a real love of books and learning? When you have these two important qualifications, love for books and love for people, you may well consider the vocation of a librarian.
Welcome to episode 14 of Adventures in Library Instruction. I am Rachel Borchard, and with me are Jason.
Hi.
And tonight we are unfortunately missing Anna Van Skoyek, who is unable to join us today. We miss you very much.
She had some lame excuse about having a month-old infant in the house. I'm not sure what that was all about. But
yeah, so we spared you guys from the crying for an hour that was sure to be in the background. So,
but we have two special guests to make up for it.
We do. So we have Margot Johnson and Missy Clapp from the University of Florida. Hi, guys.
Hello.
So can you guys tell us a bit about, well, you guys introduce yourselves first. Tell us a bit about yourselves.
Okay. This is Missy, and just in case you can't tell us apart, and I'm the instruction and outreach coordinator for UF's Humanities and Social Sciences Library, which is the biggest library on campus, although we have 9 libraries, and I do a lot of work with undergraduates, and, well, I'm sure we'll find out more about me.
And we'll hear the rest.
Yeah.
And I'm Margot Johnson, and I'm a science and technology librarian, also at the University of Florida. And I coordinate instruction for the sciences. Believe it or not, we have over 20,000 students that we serve just in the sciences.
Oh, my God, that's
kind of
huge.
A big library, I know. So it's not the largest, you know, library on campus physically, but I think it does serve the largest number of students, not coming through our doors, but as far as departmentally.
We're going to arm wrestle over that.
What is your total?
It has more departments, like individual departments.
Right. Yeah. What is your total registration if you've got 20,000 in the sciences alone?
50,000.
Wow, oh my God.
4,000?
Are you guys one of the biggest out there?
Oh.
No, UCF has beat us out this year for the first time. Okay. They have 52,000 or something.
That's right.
So, yeah, University of Florida is cutting back on admissions.
Well, Georgia State's got 30,000, and that's a record enrollment this year. And I thought that was huge. I'm stunned that you serve 50,000 students. That's amazing. But you said you have 9 libraries, though, right? Or a bunch of libraries?
Yeah, we have a couple library weirdnesses on campus. like, our law library is separate, so we don't usually count that. And, well, we have a health science center library now, too, but does that mean we have 10 on campus now since we can't?
We have 9 on campus, but then we have some off campus as well. So we have a library in Jacksonville that serves a health science population, and we have extension stations throughout the state.
Yeah.
We're also the land grant school for the state. And so there's tons of extension libraries, and at the science library, we work with all of them. So one in every county in Florida.
So that's a more complicated question than I thought when I said how many libraries. So we can just sort of fudge over that and get on to the good stuff then. Wow, that's really amazing, though, the size of the population that you guys serve. So Rachel and I met Margot in person very briefly at Computers and Libraries this year up in D.C. We did a little presentation about podcasting, and Margot came up and introduced herself. And it turned out that she was the creator or one of the creators or the co-creator of the infamous zombie libguide. And so we were immediately like, oh, yeah, come on the show. Come on the show. So
we have a little thing with zombies.
Yeah.
So if you don't know what we're talking about, we're going to put it in the show notes, of course. But tell us, let's start off. Tell us a little bit about the zombie survival libguide, please.
Sure. Well, actually, I'll start with our history of zombies at the University of Florida. I don't know, maybe more than any other university, we have this history with zombies going on, where our IT department has to create all these emergency preparedness plans. You know, like if there's hurricanes that wipe out the state of Florida, how will we get services to students?
And sure.
This year, they had to do a really detailed one for swine flu. And we had to discuss it in all of our distance learning meetings, what would we do if there was swine flu. And in conjunction with that, they decided to make one for zombie outbreaks. And so they made a detailed plan for campus-wide zombie outbreaks, what we would do at the university.
So this wasn't just the library.
No, this is really a campus culture thing.
Yeah.
And so
that is so great.
That made national news.
Exactly. It made national news, and it got out there, and the administration of the university actually made them remove it from the site.
Yeah.
But not before the library preserved it in our institutional repository.
Nice.
And so it's just been one of those campus culture things. And so it's been ongoing where, you know, students have hacked into the road signs on campus and change the road signs to say, beware zombie outbreaks, yeah. You know, stuff like that. So it's really a huge thing at University of Florida, zombies. And so there's actually a national zombie game, an alternate reality game, which for the rest of the episode I'll probably refer to as ARG.
Right, okay.
And so it's called Humans versus Zombies. It was started at Gloucester College. And it's played across the United States. So tons of colleges play this game. And the UF group, because it's such a huge college compared to other schools, they have over 1,800 members in their Facebook groups that follow the Facebook group and are interested in this alternate reality game. And this semester, they had over 1,000 players sign up to play.
Let me just interject here, and I have to make two comments. First of all, I just have to note that our administration in my library has put a moratorium on us using any more zombies in any public library material because we...
Why?
Our director, whom I love and is fantastic, doesn't get the zombie thing, and she has told us no more zombies. So I'm very happy for you. This makes me like doubly sad for me that GSU can't do any more zombie stuff. Second thing, I wanted to just ask you if you could briefly define alternate reality game, because I kind of know what it is, but just for listeners who have not heard the term before.
Yeah, so I think a lot of times nowadays we're talking more about combining the virtual and the physical. And so an alternate reality game is just one in which reality is basically enhanced. So enhanced by other ideas or virtual worlds. And so in the alternate reality game, basically a bunch of people agree to come together and they create, you could kind of call it a participatory culture, where they agree to play by the same rules and take on certain roles and live out a scenario. So in the Humans versus Zombie game, it's basically like a giant game of tag. And one person is a zombie on the first day, and they slowly infect the campus, while other people are humans that try to fight off the zombies and keep it in balance.
Okay, so how does the infection and the fighting play out? Because I don't imagine people are actually biting each other. I hope not.
No.
It's more like tags. So the zombie tags another player and they become a zombie. And everyone has on...
a headband.
Bandanas. And humans wear bandanas on their arm and zombies wear bandanas on their head.
So that's how you identify zombies and humans who are playing.
Right, okay.
Is it like a specific color or something?
No. No, just if it's on your arm or your head, then you know you're in the game.
And humans can stun the zombies using either Nerf weaponry or socks.
Balled up socks.
And they do have rules to make it civil because classes are going on during the time period. And so you can't play inside of any building or inside of any residence hall.
So they're safe zones.
And you can't play on stairs. So they keep a pretty...
Because that's dangerous.
Yeah, they try to make it safe. And so it's basically just a really huge game of tag. And they built us into their culture and were very receptive to us being part of their culture.
Oh, great. So I was about to ask, so how is the library tying it into this? And how are you tying it into instruction stuff?
How did you learn about it?
Okay, so this is Margo again. I was at a workshop in one of our largest buildings. The Liberal Arts and Science College has this building called Turlington. And I was at a workshop in Turlington, and there were posters up everywhere that just said, "This area will be under quarantine," and gave the date and a URL. And I thought, I have to follow up on this. And that's a big thing about alternate reality games. It's a lot of people who are willing to follow the clues. People who are willing to jump down that rabbit hole.
Because a lot of them are more sort of mystery based, as opposed, this sounds sort of, you know, physical tag kind of stuff, but I've heard of a lot of them that are like all about the clues and, you know, uncovering a sort of a backstory and things like that.
Right. And within this game, there were a lot of clues and a lot of secret missions that could get you special privileges within the game.
Oh my God, this is so awesome.
Yeah, so it was really large scale, and it is pretty awesome. And the kids behind it, I mean, because they are these kids that follow the clues, they're a very special kind of participatory student. And so
they're the ones who make it work, really.
Yeah, they're the ones that make this work. And so I basically followed the clue, and I read about how there was going to be this game on campus during certain dates, and I thought, this is amazing. And since we had this history already of zombies on campus, and I knew other librarians that were interested in zombies, I called up about a dozen librarians, and I said, this game is happening next week. I think we should do something for the library.
Yeah, capitalize on the action.
Yeah, and so I saw it on a Thursday, and Missy and I met for lunch Friday with three other librarians, including our library graphic designer web person, Matthew Daly, who has an amazing zombie background. He's from England and and lives and breathes zombies. And so
because he's English.
Exactly. I guess about five or six of us decided we should definitely do something, and we started the LibGuide that day.
Yeah.
And by Friday evening at 5, we posted a LibGuide to their Facebook group.
So as of this point, the library zombie event was not part of the human versus zombie game on campus. Okay. So
it was just thematically tied in somehow.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
So all we did was we put this LibGuide onto their Facebook page, which has 1,800 people involved. And the students freaked out. They got so excited. They're like, other people on campus are paying attention to what we're doing. It was overwhelmingly positive. I mean, we posted it at 5 o'clock on a Friday, and by Monday morning, 1,000 people had visited.
Yeah.
Wow.
It exploded over the weekend. Like, you could tell people were sending the link to their friends because there were that many hits.
And what kind of response were you getting?
Like, positive.
Very positive. You can actually see comments that people made on the LibGuide, which doesn't happen very often. Our students and patrons never really comment on our LibGuides.
Right.
But this one, there's comments everywhere.
Yeah, people started commenting on the LibGuide, on the Facebook page commenting, getting really excited about it. And so by Monday, we decided we definitely need to go through with having some sort of game. And the lead moderator for the ARG, Humans vs. Zombies, contacted me personally because he saw my name associated with the LibGuide. And actually, it didn't have my profile box on the LibGuide, so he had to look up my name in the staff directory and find me. And he invited us to create a mission, which is a game within the game, for their ARG.
Okay, so that you actually got tied into the actual game itself at that point because they made
yes.
mission. Oh, that's so great.
And not just tied in, we got lead mission status. So the first mission that would occur in the game would be a library
yeah.
mission.
The very first one ever?
This was actually the first time they had played Humans vs. Zombies on UF campus.
Woohoo!
And we got to be the first mission in the game.
Wow. Yeah. So you're in on the ground.
The very first one ever.
Did they come to you with ideas of, like, what it is they wanted you guys to do?
No, they didn't want to know anything. It was all up to us.
Secrecy is a big deal with the HVZ. You know, the humans don't want the zombies to know what's going on, and vice versa.
Right.
So they can plot against each other.
So what did you guys end up doing?
So,
or can you say?
Oh, yes, because once it runs out, we will have to come up with new ideas for future ones.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about it a little
sure,
bit?
Sure. Well, last summer, so 2009, one of the students who's in our Freshman Leadership Council, which is a branch of our student government, emailed me and said, I'm hosting this wild event out on the Plaza of the Americas, which is like our quad on campus. The library faces it. And we wanted to have a fun event just for new students, but we think it should be academic too. So we were thinking of doing something in the library. What do you think? And I wrote back and I said, yeah, let's get together and talk about this. I have some ideas. And I came up with I wanted it to be fun because these are it was meant just for brand new freshmen. They were actually going to go into the dorms and pull the freshmen out by their ponytails if they needed to. So just to get them out and meeting people and having fun. So I came up with the idea for Capture the Info Flag, which is like this five-step game where there's it was three or four. So I had, I just came up with four tasks, and they were meant to get the students, first of all, into the library and into key areas for services or books, you know, just to learn about things library related. And at each point, there was a flag that they had to collect. And they collected the four flags, and then they got their pizza ticket. So once they did capture the info flag in the library, they could participate in the activities outside in the Plaza of the Americas. So anyway, that event was enormously successful. We had over 500 students come just for that. And based on the success rate we had with that, I mean, it was just a quick and really easy thing, yet they learned so much. Margo wanted to use the Capture the Info flag as sort of a basis, for the zombie game.
Right.
So Missy's ability to have 500 kids in the library at one time, of course, we had no idea how many people would show up for our zombie game. And so we thought it just needed to be simplified tasks. But we did sit down and write out basic learning objectives. And so you have to remember we had less than a week to plan it.
Yeah.
So basically, we split it up between four librarians that would handle the clues, and we worked out the learning objectives. And the overarching theme of the game was that if there was a zombie attack, students would need to be able to access electronic resources from safe, secure locations. And so sticking with that theme, we decided that we would teach them how to access electronic reserves, how to find maps online through our map and imagery collection,
uh-huh.
how to
find an article citation.
Right, how to find an article using Web of Science. And
the fourth one
was how to text a book to their cell phone so that they could run in and out of the library quickly. Text a call number. And we worked zombies into the clues in every way. So the map and imagery library clue, they actually had to go into the map library, and we had pulled out ancient maps that we have of Haiti, because we have lots of maps of the Caribbean that date back to like the 1500s. And so we pulled out maps of Haiti and put them in the display case, and the map and imagery library got really into it.
They dressed up like zombies.
and they did all these displays of like maps of outbreaks and places to hide, like maps of where forts were in Florida, stuff like that. And so the students had to look through the maps of Haiti and find a specific city, and then find electronic maps of that city to proceed to the next clue. The electronic reserves task, they actually had to add a class and set up an electronic reserves account, and then give the clue of a citation from that article to someone at the circulation desk.
Yeah.
For the text-to-call number, they had to go into the catalog, text it to their cell phone using our catalog feature, and then find it up in the fourth floor stacks, and they would receive certification from that person. And so for the articles, they had to actually find an article about the chemical components for zombie attacks. I mean, not zombie attacks, but when in Haiti, when they induce zombieism in victims, actual plants. And so there was a chemistry article in Web of Science that analyzed those plants, and so they had to give the chemical components from that article.
Wow. So you actually, there's actual learning going on in here amongst the zombie activities.
Yeah.
That's pretty amazing. I'm gonna play this for some of my bosses and let them hear this, and maybe they will rescind the zombie moratorium.
Yeah.
And so play this for them. The event brought in how many students, Margo?
200. Yeah. And 184 completed all the tasks to get certified as library prepared. So, and they actually, I mean, I had students afterwards saying things like, I had never been able to get into users, and now I've done it and downloaded an article. things like that.
And every time they do it, they're going to remember the awesome zombie event, too. So
we hope so.
Right. And I think beyond just learning about the libraries, we're really fostering an environment that shows them that they can come collaborate in the library, that they can have fun in the library.
Yeah.
And that was definitely one of the objectives we had with this game when we listed them beforehand.
Absolutely, because they worked on teams when they came into the library for the event, so that was okay. And it was something we encouraged. And a lot of people actually met each other for the first time because people would come by themselves wanting to do the event, and then they would hook up with another group who was already there participating. So they got to meet new people, too.
Exactly. So games are a wonderful way to learn. And I think this brings us into like building 21st century skills. And I feel like in libraries, we focus so heavily on the 21st century skill of information literacy, because that fits closely with our goals. Mm-hmm. But there's these other 21st century skills that we as libraries can really, really foster. And so one of those is definitely providing the space for collaboration and providing environments that allow people to collaborate. And as the first mission of the game, we really saw people form these squadrons that lasted throughout the game, and that was a really cool role to be able to play.
Oh, fantastic. And that fits the zombie, you know, the classic zombie movie feel as well. You know, you have your little group of survivors. But, I mean, you really, it sounds like you're really finding some ways to create positive associations for the library. I mean, you're obviously teaching them stuff, but this has got to be so much fun for the students that they really are going to have some of those positive associations that you're talking about with the library. This just is amazing to me. You guys are just blowing my mind with this.
and I don't know if Jason and Rachel, I don't know if either of you have looked really heavily into these 21st century skills beyond the ones we usually talk about in libraries with info literacy. But I really think that libraries have the opportunity to teach more of these. So when you talk about like the partnership for 21st century skills, and it's basically, I don't know if you've ever seen this framework, but it's basically like a rainbow where you have an arch. Uh-huh. At the lower level of the arch is this core subjects, where you're teaching the actual core subjects, which is never really something that libraries have done. But overarching that is teaching these other skills, like information literacy skills and media literacy skills and learning and innovation skills. And these are all things that libraries really can be involved in and embedded with a core subject to overlay.
I haven't seen this framework before. Is there a name for that if people want to research it?
Yeah, it's called the Framework for 21st Century Learning.
Okay, great.
Put it in the show notes.
We will put a link to something about that in the show notes. Yeah, and if you have a link to give us for that, then let us know and we'll put it in there.
Yeah, it's just p21.org.
Oh, great. Okay.
Yeah, so it's the Partnership for 21st Century Skills, and I think another really great article to read that informs this is from the MacArthur Foundation, an article by Jenkins, and it's Confronting the Challenges of Participatory Culture, Media Education for the 21st Century. And in that, he really talks about new skills that students are going to need to succeed in the 21st century. And he talks about how, some of these things are like collaborative problem solving. So students are going to need the ability to work together in teams. And a game is the perfect place to exercise something like that.
I don't know if that's something that has it seems like that's something that has changed since I was an undergrad. From the time that I finished undergrad until the time that I went to library school, which is not that long ago, I was doing a lot of group work and a lot of collaborative work in mm-hmm. grad school, and I see a lot more collaborative projects going on now that I'm a librarian. That really seems to be sort of a shift in the teaching culture, and I have found that really interesting. I was working with a class just yesterday that had me come in and do a session about Zotero, and they were actually using Zotero, and they were building group libraries as part of their assignment, as their assignment. And it just seems like there's a lot more collaborative assignments going on now than I remember as a student anyway.
Yeah, definitely.
In MBA programs now, pretty much everything that you do is part of a group, just because in the business world, you'll always be, preparing presentations and stuff as a group. So I think some of it is probably dependent on which discipline you go into, but definitely I'm seeing a lot of group work. And I know for me personally, I've tried to use it in class, instead of lecturing and dividing them into group and giving them activities. I think what you guys are talking about is just like definitely like the next generation of what we can do, as instructors to make it more engaging.
It's
pretty much taking every element out of a classroom, but still having an educational component. Very cool.
Yeah, I think that's very true, Rachel. And I think that one of these things is maybe we can't cover as much material if we're adding this creativity in. But I feel like the students are really going to retain more when it's tied into the creativity and when they're making these discoveries on their own.
More engaged with what we're giving them makes it a lasting experience.
And I think that's a good process to go through, to think, what is the most important thing that they need to know? And I mean, when you guys listed what they had to do, it's like, yeah, those are the things that students really need the library for. How to find a book in the library is a very basic, handy skill for them to have.
Sure is. Rachel, when you mention how in MBA programs the students are working more and more in teams because that's what it's like in the real-life business world, that's something that Margot and I are really working hard on because we work in separate libraries. You would think that our teams would be within our own individual libraries, but Margot and I don't really go for that kind of thing. So we really work together to do as many things as possible. So we consider ourselves a team, even though we're in opposite, in different, totally different libraries that cover totally different subjects.
Mm-hmm. And I think this is actually something that's really important in sciences. I know Rachel's a science librarian like me, and in sciences now, the problems have gotten so complex that to solve problems, you have to work in really large teams. And so the ability to collaborate as a group is more and more important.
Absolutely. And I think you guys are a great demonstration of how really even the old group models aren't necessarily the best anymore, that sometimes the best work can come out of really disparate groups, you know, working across libraries, and even having people who aren't necessarily instruction librarians, you know, collaborating on a project like that, just to get new ideas and different perspectives in the mix.
Yeah, so another one of these skills that Jenkins talks about in this participatory culture is affiliations, and so like your memberships, and you're not just a member of one group, you're members of several groups, and he talks about this ability to like move between groups and how important that is. And I think for us as librarians, that becomes really important because you're moving as a member of different departments, as a member with other librarians. So you're switching all through these affiliations that strengthen your position. So I know like when I work with my departments, they value my skills as a librarian, and that's what I can bring to the table for them. So a lot of times you'll get asked to participate in a grant because of your librarian skills, because maybe you can do something like user testing for that grant.
And I know like at the university level, they're really trying to emphasize having, bringing those different partners together in different ways and kind of discovering ways that different people that might not normally talk to each other about their work, how they can get together and work together. You know, it's a huge kind of upcoming thing of like, let's get all of the university research talking together and collaborating in new and different ways and producing work that you wouldn't expect. And I think
That's definitely happening all across UF.
Yeah. Right now I'm involved in at a very minor level in a very large grant that's happening actually at six different institutions in the United States.
Oh, wow.
But the lead institution is UF, and it's called the VIVO grant, V-I-V-O, and it's building a national network of scientists from the NIH. And on our campus, we've decided to include all researchers in the VIVO grant. And it's basically a giant semantic web database that will help researchers discover other researchers doing certain types of work to foster collaboration.
Yeah. That was a big discussion at Emory's campus. I remember hearing about VIVO and how, I mean, this is probably getting a little off topic, but the roles that a library can play in facilitating those connections. And I know, like in the sciences, our director definitely saw the science library as like the central meeting spot for these kind of serendipitous research conversations.
Yeah.
Well, and when I think about it all the time, we're in such a great place to connect people as librarians. We can really serve that role as a connector in the community.
Absolutely, because we have access to so many different people's research.
And we touch so many different parts of campus life. I mean, from we all know not every student is using the library, but potentially, you know, from freshmen up to senior faculty and administrators, and you know, and everybody could potentially be using our services or our information anyway. So.
And I think the core service of the library is to serve as the intellectual commons. Right, to the university. So it kind of makes sense that that applies not just to the research, but to the people as well.
Yeah. Yeah, the library is what all of the different people and departments have in common.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And it's just making those connections and bringing everyone together. I think that's going to be a big part of our job in the future, especially in the science.
I kind of feel like, yeah, I'm... You know, Rachel knows anyway that I'm relatively new to the role of subject librarian, and I feel like that's really kind of where I'm very much still an apprentice, and I'm sort of learning what are the really great ways to do this kind of outreach and partnership stuff. So this kind of things that you guys are talking about are just really interesting to me, because I feel like I have so much to learn in, you know, what are the interesting and creative and effective ways that people are you know, doing this kind of outreach and these kinds of partnerships with different units on campus and different segments of the population.
So. I'm with you, Jason. I'm not a subject librarian either. I don't buy books.
Yeah. So that's something I'm still learning how to do, too. And I'm, like, just finishing my first year of doing that and panicking because I'm finishing my first budget. But
oh, no.
I'm almost there. I've got, like, a week to go. I'm going to do it. But
I have $1,000 to spend.
I do. I'm down to, like, $500, I think, or $700 or something. I can do that in a week, so.
Well, to bring this back to what we were talking about earlier, Marco and Missy, do you have tips for people that are kind of looking to get more involved, you know, with the students, even with the faculty, like we were just talking about, but other than, like, looking for signs of zombie attacks invading the library,
what have
you guys done to become more immersed?
Yeah, if you've got, like, 5 or 10 minutes of best practices you can sum up for us, that would be awesome.
Well, for me, when I was first hired, I was hired as an instruction librarian, and then all of this outreachy type of stuff got plopped on me because people left. And so I didn't really have anybody to to guide me as to what I should be doing. So I started to think about, what do students do? What are student groups on campus? And I just thought of the Dean of Students' Office. And we had already been involved with Preview, which is when it's like freshman orientation. So they have this big information fair, and the libraries always were represented at that event with a table. And, you know, somebody from the libraries was there to answer questions and hand out stuff. So I started figuring out that the Dean of Students' Office was sort of the place to be, because they reached so many students, and I could work with some of their organizations within their office. So, for example, they do this Weeks of Welcome thing, and they have part of the Weeks of Welcome, they have certain events that can be considered official Weeks of Welcome events, and they put it on their calendars, they post it on their Facebook page, they add it to the literature they send out to the students coming in. And so I was like, we need to get on this calendar. So we started having some events. For example, our Mystery in the Stacks event was an official Weeks of Welcome event. And so students came to that just because they saw that it was an official Weeks of Welcome event. And so we also talked to there's lots of sort of mini departments within the Dean of Students' Office. So, like, new student programs, the first year Florida groups. And so I would, my best advice to somebody trying to figure out what to do more on campus or wherever they work, large campuses or small campuses, they all have a Dean of Students' Office. Get in contact with somebody there. Make yourself known and be willing to work with them. And I'm so lucky at UF, our Dean of Students people are awesome. They are just so full of life and just really happy, good, go-get 'em people. And they're so great to work with. So I'm really lucky in that respect because they never say no whenever I have an idea.
You know, it seems like sometimes the key is just figure out who on campus are, you know, really enthusiastic supporters of the library and who's willing to you know, roll with your ideas and your suggestions.
That's true.
Yeah.
This is Margo, and I have two best practices words of advice. The first one is leave your office. So for 30 minutes a day, make sure that, like, you go outside, that you walk across the quad. My library is really close to the highest traffic point on campus, which is Turlington Plaza. And so I make sure that I walk through it once a day, and you get a good idea of what's going on campus. Mm-hmm. You pick up the student flyers, and that's been really great. My other suggestion, I'm the instruction coordinator for science, and One thing that I try to do anytime I teach a class, I show up 20 minutes early and open the door. Mm-hmm. And I talk to every student as they come in. Mm-hmm. And I probably teach about 800 students a semester.
Wow.
And so, you know, as they come in, I make the personal connection. What's your major? What have you been doing? What's this class like? Mm-hmm. A lot of times their TAs or professors don't show up early, but the students are out there waiting. And that's really led to a lot of connections, a lot of students following up, coming to my office when they're studying in the library. They run in with their laptops. Mm-hmm. I've done this search. Can you help me with it? And so I find that to really break the ice. For instance, Missy and I were teaching a wonderful class for McNair Scholars this week.
That's right.
And
Yesterday.
And are you guys familiar with the McNair program?
No, I'm not anyway.
Okay. It's a program for minority students that are undergraduates that know that they want to get a PhD, even though they're just undergraduates.
So. Yeah.
And so very advanced students. And
juniors and seniors.
Yeah. By spending the first couple minutes with them before class and just talking to them and asking about their research interests and why they want to get a PhD mm-hmm. and making that connection of how we can help them through it and how the libraries can help them through it, they get really excited about that. And there's a really personal connection. You know, during the class break, one of the girls said, I'm going to make a Facebook group so that we can collaborate and all know each other. And we're going to invite you guys to be part of our Facebook group.
Yay. Yeah, the librarians.
And, you know, I think things like that are just such wonderful opportunities for us to work with students that really want to learn.
Yeah, and also last night during the break, something else magical happened that I didn't actually get to tell you about. One of the students, she was so scared. She said, how long is break? And I said, oh, 5 minutes. You've got plenty of time to do whatever you want. And she said, well, I was wondering if, I don't know if we'll have time, but, and she wanted me to go to the first floor with her to show her how to work the call numbers and how to work the compact shelving, because the stuff terrified her. And she said, I'm so ashamed. I'm a senior and I've never checked out a book. And I'm just so afraid and I'm going to get lost. And, but you're so nice. And, you know, I can do it if you're with me.
Wow. So, that's what you want to hear though. I mean, that's amazing. If she was obviously that, I mean, just from that story, I can tell she was obviously really intimidated, but you had obviously done a great job in like getting past that with your demeanor. So that's awesome. Well done.
Yeah, so I really think just that showing up and unlocking mm-hmm. the doors early and having informal conversations as the students filter in has led to so many collaborative opportunities with the students. I mean, students from another student group, Florida Free Culture, mm-hmm. got really excited about our open access initiative on campus, which I led last year, and, you know, started talking to us about that just because of an informal conversation before a workshop where they offered to have workshops in the library about how to use open source software and get other students involved and interested.
So. Oh, I'm drooling. I've been wanting to start a free culture chapter or something, because these are all things that I'm really excited about. I'm a big Lawrence Lessig fan and, you know, talk about open source and stuff all the time. That's so great that you guys have a student group, though, that's interested in it.
Oh, yeah. They contact us a couple times a semester to say, hey, this is coming up. Can we do it in the library?
Yeah. And I think that's a really important thing, too, is providing the space, like not necessarily taking over from the students, but allowing them to be peer teachers. And that's something that Missy and I have tried to push a lot. We just finished a peer video project.
Yeah, where the students, our student assistants, created short tutorial type videos. So it's like the students are teaching the students.
So they scripted them, they came up with ideas for them, and we basically let them write their scripts and edit it and make everything on their own.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's really effective. So sort of back to the original question about best practices, one thing that we haven't mentioned that Margot and I are really into is using a student group on campus, like with the zombie group, and you know, joining forces. So like with Capture the Info Flag, the student government. So teaming up with a student organization for our programming. Uh-huh. We found that is one of the big keys to success.
We did some of that at Emory. And Rachel, I don't remember if it was, if you were involved in the film screenings that we did. You remember those though, right?
I don't. We actually just started doing something very similar in America.
Oh, okay. Well, we did this at Emory a couple of times. We did film screenings, and we would tie it in with a student group. And we did a couple of theme nights like we did, like for Gay Pride Month, we had the GBLTQ Alphabet Soup Alphabet Soup group, and we had one of their officers come and do you know, give a little talk before the movie, just, you know, 5 minutes or something. Here's why this is a great movie. We showed was it called Latter Days or something like that? But they recommended the film to us. We bought a copy of the DVD and we gave it away as a door prize at the end. And we did that with Good Night, Good Luck for the September project for like, you know, talking about freedoms and personal liberties and things like that. And we did a book exhibit as well. And we had a this wasn't a student group we tied it in with, but we had a well-known prof come over and give a talk about Good Night and Good Luck, and we gave the DVD away as well. So that's something I feel like we don't do enough of at Georgia State, is sort of having the space for student events, because we have a couple of large classrooms that we could use for presentations and student meetings and stuff like that. But we have sort of a closed door policy about outside, about people outside the libraries booking it, because they're leery about it getting just, you know, people thinking that it's just extra classroom space when we do book it a lot for classes. But
we have the same problem.
Yeah.
We actually have in our Info Commons space that's just with full of comfy chairs, and we clear that out, or, you know, make a better chair set up for special events. So they're not in a classroom, and it also makes it feel less formal, so students feel more comfortable. So it's like they're looking for a place to study and they end up in the program.
Surprise.
I'm fortunate enough that I coordinate the classroom space at the science library, so I can make the decision whether or not to book it. And I only book it when it's really a collaboration with me, so I'm physically there, and it's made clear that it's not just there for a meeting space, but that it's there for actually holding workshops and inviting other people for collaborative type activities. So.
Yeah. We actually have to say that our classrooms are conference rooms, so that the registrar's office won't take over them.
Oh, very clever.
Well, if I can add to your list, sorry.
Yeah, of course.
One thing that I think is kind of underlying all of these best practices that you guys have been talking about seems to be just the being open to new possibilities and opportunities, but also more importantly, being flexible enough that you can take advantage of it. I'm stunned that you guys were able to pull off something in a week that obviously involved multiple departments and involved, you know, lots of people coordinating together to handle this large group. And I don't know how many libraries could really pull that off. So well done.
Well, I
gotta want it.
I was also very lucky enough that I kind of had a model for this when I was in library school at University of Maryland. We developed an alternate reality game as one of our class projects. Mm-hmm. And so I had the model set up in my mind already that it actually would work and come together if the responsibilities were delegated to separate individuals for each clue. Mm-hmm. And so there is no problem with being able to just delegate various parts of the game and know that it would all come together in the end.
Wow, that's fantastic. I would want to, like, come and work with you guys if you weren't in Florida.
Do you not like Florida?
I don't like Florida.
This is Margo, and I love Florida.
You're a Floridian. I'm a Pennsylvanian.
Well, we kind of need to wrap up in just a minute or two. Is there anything that we haven't gotten the chance to talk about that you guys want to touch on real quick?
Not that I can think of, but we'd love to work with you guys in the future if there's any projects you want to try to run on multiple campuses.
Yeah.
I love that idea. I'm just so excited by some of the stuff you guys are talking about. And like Rachel said, I'm just blown away that, you know, you were able to pull these some of this stuff together in such a short time and, you know, across different units and all that. That's just amazing. So
I really look forward to hearing what else you guys managed to stumble onto and plan for. It's just so cool.
Yeah, please keep in touch with us, and we'd love to have you back on, you know, after your next big initiative and hear what other cool stuff you guys are doing.
That'd be awesome.
This has been really fun. Thank you guys so much for the time. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for the invitation.
Yeah.
We don't have cookies. We only have books. Just books. No cookies.
We have received some viewer mail in the form of an audio question. So we're going to play a shortened version of the question. It was actually about 5 minutes, so we just kind of distilled it down to 1 minute. So here's the question.
Hi to you guys at Adventures in Library Instruction. This is Ricardo at Amigo Audio, located in San Jose, Costa Rica, and I love your podcasts. So I'm hoping you guys might describe the state of the modern library in the U.S. and Canada, and where is the library headed? With so much information on the Internet, is there a future for the local library where I have spent so much of my life? Thanks for terrific and very fun podcasts. I would like to send in some more comments and questions, particularly about information management for dummies like me. How to deal with the bottomless cornucopia of available information, which I think you guys teach. I'll be waiting for you in Costa Rica. Hasta la próxima. Until next time. Thanks and a big adios, amigos.
So, Jason, what are your immediate thoughts?
So, this is a big question. We'll try and give it like a 2-minute answer. And, you know, I kind of think this is what every librarian is answering for the rest of their career.
Definitely.
So I'm going to sort of think about it from the point of view of library instruction, since that's the topic of our show. I see a lot more technology in the classroom, and I think we're all kind of figuring out how to incorporate more technology into the info literacy classroom. You know, we went to the Apple store. Some people from my work went to the Apple store and got to test drive some iPads, and I was thinking what a great teaching tool that would make. I'm not a fan of the iPad as such, but the tablet format just seems like it would be a great thing to take into the classroom with you. And, I mean, we've got to keep up with the students, how they're using technology. Ricardo was asking about, he's in Costa Rica, so he's asking about these small local public libraries that, you know, are still all over North America and all over the world, I guess. And I see a great future for the small local public library because you can get so much more information thanks to the Internet than you used to be able to, you know, instantly. So I don't know, Rachel, what do you think? What would you add to that?
I think I would add that the way in which we incorporate some of the things that people are encountering in everyday life is going to change the way we do instruction, and that you're always going to have evaluation as a component, and I think that's even more important than ever now, because there's so much more information that everyone has access to, right? I think we say this a lot, but it used to be that the library was where you went to get access to information, and I think in the future the library is going to be where you go to get access about how to use the information, about how to figure out what it is that you're looking at, or even be taught tools in order to find and use, you know, and how to use some of these technology components.
I'm really amazed with some of our guests and even the stuff Anna's doing at what I think is a relatively small public library, you know, in the way of teaching people how to use information. And I just, you know, I'm really... We've got to remember that there's still an information divide all over the world. I mean, in the U.S., still a lot of people are relying on public libraries for their internet access. There's a huge part of the population of the U.S. that's still using public libraries as their internet provider. So I don't see them going away anytime soon in this country.
Absolutely. And I think libraries will always play a role in providing things that people wouldn't otherwise have access to, even if it's whether it's internet access itself or it's understanding how to use what you have. Like something Anna's doing, you know, teaching people how to use Facebook, something as simple as that. I think there will always be that need.
Yep. Okay, thank you so much, Ricardo. We hope to hear from you again in the future. Sorry, we had to cut your question down. It was quite a long, involved question, and we had to sort of get to the meat of it. So please excuse us for editing you down a little bit. We've actually got another piece of mail here. This is from Margaret Eves, and she writes, "Hey there, Jason, Anna, and Rachel. I just discovered Adventures in Library Instruction. I heard the most recent podcast with Buffy Hamilton. Thank you, Buffy, which was awesome. I worked in a 6th to 12th grade private school library until my position was cut. Ooh, really sorry to hear that. So I'm really excited about what Buffy is doing with high school students. I'm subscribed to The Unquiet Librarian," that's Buffy's blog, "but it's great to hear her voice. She says, I'm going back and listening to all the ad lib podcasts, which is fun. Really enjoying the give and take between the three of you. We miss Anna tonight. I'm learning a lot. Although I don't have a paying gig right now, I'm trying to figure out ways to keep my teaching muscles in shape. You've inspired me to get out and attend some of the local Atlanta Library Association meetings. So maybe I'll see you there, Margaret. My question in caps," she says, "what is immersion? You've mentioned it a few times. It sounds like some training conference, but who sponsors it? I've never heard of it. Keep up the good work. I will be listening. Margaret Eves." Thank you, Margaret. Rachel, you've been to immersion, and I haven't. So
I have. So you may be able to say more about the actual details because I forgot to look it up. It's an ACRL-sponsored, I think it's called an institute, maybe. But it's essentially an immersive experience in library instruction, which is how it got the name immersion, because you're being immersed in the culture. But it's really like a library instruction boot camp. They get some of the best minds in library instruction, and you are there with maybe about 50 to 70 other people.
Oh, wow, I didn't know it was that big.
Yeah, it's fairly large. There's now four different tracks. When I was there, there were two tracks, one for librarian teachers and one for management. And it's all just looking at how can you be a better teacher and how can we make information literacy better at your place, wherever you are, at whatever level you are.
Yeah, and it's more than just like a conference. You don't just pay admission and go. You have to like apply and have support from your institution for, you know, this is why this person should be accepted.
Yeah.
And they take like a couple of people from each institution, or maybe that was just what we were sending.
I mean, it's not guaranteed that anyone will get in.
Yeah, so it's like something you have to apply to and get accepted to.
You have to have support not only from your administration, but you have to have outside support outside the library. So I had to get a letter of support from a professor that I work with talking about the relationship we have and the instruction that we've done together. And they really do take it seriously, and you have projects that you work on the entire time. You know, you're constantly engaged in activities, and at the end you get to take home your workbook. But it's everything from pedagogy to how to talk to administrators and how to do assessment. It's amazing. And everyone that's there is really engaged in library instruction. I can't say enough good things about it. It was one of the best weeks of my life.
Everybody I know who has gone to it, and I've got three or four friends at least who have gone to it, have just had nothing but wonderful things to say about it. It's geared toward academic librarians specifically, right, since it's ACRL, or do you have people from other types of libraries?
I'm trying to think. I think it is academic libraries only.
Okay.
I don't know if it's excluded, but there's definitely a lot of topics, you know, about like, hey, if you meet the president of your institution in an elevator and you have 20 seconds, you know, preparing how you would talk to them and, you know, how you would phrase your speech and that kind of thing. So there are definitely, it definitely has an academic bent to it. And things like, you know, the orientation at the beginning of the year, you know, coming up with ideas for that or something like that.
Cool.
So, yeah.
I really do want to go to it at some point. They've just changed the requirements, I think. So like I'm no longer qualified. I kept saying after I finished library school I was going to go.
I think this time last year when we talked about it, there were two tracks, and they had just decided that you had to be a teacher for 5 or more years, which is, I assume, what you're referring to. But this year, it seems that they have doubled the number of tracks. So that they have intentional teacher, which is for teachers that have been teaching 5 or more years, but they also just have a regular track, and I don't think that there's a requirement for the number of years now.
Oh, okay.
And then assessment is its separate track, and I don't think management is a track anymore. I could be wrong. I was just briefly looking at this, but I know there's 4 tracks now, and okay. I think that at least one of them doesn't have that requirement anymore.
Well, I need to look at it again. Thank you for your question, Margaret. We forget sometimes that we're like talking about stuff and not defining it, and we should make no assumptions about. I didn't realize that. I guess I never really thought about it, that it's just an academic librarian thing, and public and school librarians and special librarians might not necessarily go to it. So, okay, thank you. We really appreciate the mail. Keep writing. Thanks. Adventures in Library Instruction is produced by Rachel Borcher, Jason Puckett, and Anna Van Skoig. It's released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial License. To subscribe, go to our website at adlibinstruction.blogspot.com. Leave comments and suggestions on the blog or email us at adlibinstruction@gmail.com. Our opening theme song is Dropping Out of School by Brad Sucks, and our closing theme is Higher Education by the Napoleon Bonapartes. Both are available at magnatune.com.
Contact the library schools and the American Library Association. They are able to give you valuable advice.